Now, first of all, this one shows just one of the many possible measurables for the growth of science in the last few centuries since the Scientific Revolution. Scientific Revolution, 1665, on the extreme left, with the first two scientific journals. This measures the number of scientific journals that were founded. Of course, most of the ones founded have died since. So that we have now not 100,000, but more like 20 to 30,000 scientific journals really alive. Now, first thing to note is that, in a way, the Scientific Revolution was premature, according to this graph. You see, you get a jump up to the first 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then you wait a while, and only by the time that there are about a dozen journals founded does it settle down to that steady exponential growth that you get all the way up to the top. Now, the top figures are uncertain because it's sort of difficult to count when there's so many now. But that is about a doubling every somewhere between 10 and 15 years, fairly steadily through the 18th, 19th, and most of the 20th century. Now, when there were about 300 journals in existence, round about the year 1830, round about the beginning of organic chemistry, people threw up their hands with horror against there being so much coming out that nobody could keep up with 300 journals. So they started the world's first abstract journal telling you what was in the 300 journals. And because the number of journals kept going and could keep going, because now you could keep up with them by reading the abstract journals went up and up after an uneven beginning, and we were at the stage in the 1950s when there were about 300 abstract journals going, and people were saying, again, you couldn't keep up with it all, and that is about the time that the first computerized information systems came on the scene fairly effectively, and the number of such networks and systems has been growing with about a doubling every 10 years or so, and we are somewhat on the way up to there being the 300 systems, at which point people will throw up their hands with horror and say computers are not enough, there must be an easier way, and then we'll think up the easier way and go on again. This one is nice because it shows you part of the history that you now know in a little detail. It shows the rise of the number of known chemical elements from the 18th century right the way through to the present. Now, what happens is that the big up is round about 1800 to 1810, you see, there were about 10 chemical elements known since deep antiquity and not even identified as elements. And you get a steady exponential rise. And then 1800 to 1810, that's the time that current electricity comes in as a chemical force. And you discover nearly all the elements. You get up to the first 50, and then gradually fill in the holes. By the time you've got 60 or so chemical elements, there aren't any more to find. There are indeed, round about 1880, they find the rare earths, the noble gases, and the radioactive substances, but not by chemical means. These are all found by a different sort of thing than wet chemistry, by physical means. Anyhow, they do provide another escalation up to about 90 elements, and then nothing more happens until the period of World War II, when up there on the top we manufacture the transuranic elements, the super heavy elements, using the new nuclear chemistry. And now we've got
about as many of those as you can get that way, and the curve has been flat at about 110 ever since that happened, and we're waiting now for the elements on the so-called island of stability of the super heavy elements that we haven't discovered yet but think might be there. Well, if indeed they are, that would be another escalation. If not, then that curve is saturated. And you can see how it goes. It is more or less three distinct revolutions, one of wet chemistry at the bottom, then one of physics, and then another of nuclear chemistry. And if there is another one to find, we'll give it another name later. But this is the typical saturated growth curve. There simply weren't any more elements to find.
Yeah.
Is there a strong expectation that as we explore space and develop better means for studying stars with respect to us and so forth, that we will discover elements that are not most on the planet?
No, indeed. It's a good question, but on the contrary, the answer, interestingly enough, is no. We have strong expectation that there are no other elements. And in fact, one of the exciting things that happened in the 19th century with the spectroscope was the wonderful discovery that even in the most distant stars, there were exactly the same elements that we had on Earth, and therefore the same sort of physical laws. And now we know the structure of the chemical elements and the reasons for their stability, it's quite clear that unless something absolutely brand new happens with a new type of phenomenon that we haven't envisaged, that's it. There might be these super heavy elements they thought they'd discovered earlier this year in the halos in Mica, but that turned out to be a false alarm. And now there haven't been any elements since. But you see, it's also in this an illustration of the way in which the heads you're counting change subtly. You think that you're counting chemical elements, and you know what a chemical element is. But the discoveries are very different things. The lot at the bottom, up to number 60, are the sort of chemical elements that you'll meet in a chemistry lab. The next lot were the ones that were discovered through physics. I mean, the rare gases, noble gases, don't have any chemical compounds, or were thought not to have. Now they do. The rare earths are something rather special in structure, a group that's very difficult to distinguish. And the radioactives that were something quite different again. Okay? Now, here's another one of these exponential growth things, where I want to go further than I did in the lecture.
You really have your eyes shut. Please.
This is the growth in the number of physics abstracts from about World War One to the present. Now, you can't see World War One very clearly on this, because physics abstracts was really getting organized and becoming distinct from electrical engineering abstracts at this time. But what I want to show you is what happens in World War II. You can see the dotted line on the left of the way the number was growing, and then along comes the war and the growth slows, and then when it starts again, it is the same curve, just displaced sideways. Now, I want to show you that in greater detail and accuracy on this one. Now, could somebody near it just focus that a little? No, there's a nod. Very good. Now, that is the same curve plotted with real points, but on logarithmic paper, that is, it goes up by jumps of 10 on the left instead of going up normally, 1, 10, 100, 1,000 per year. And on that you can see now the World War II thing much more clearly and accurately, and the little jump up it gives
after the war, settling down to the same slope that it had before the war. And this is my evidence for saying that, on the whole, the war has no effect on science. The lesser rate during World War II is there simply because some of the work being done was not published. And it was some of that was published after the war. It gives you this very rapid post-war growth as we tip everything that had spilt over back into the bucket. And you can see World War I is a similar declining phase, and then I drew the slope, a doubling in 10 years that lasts up to the end of World War I. And after, between the wars and after World War II, the doubling time is much greater, a doubling every 3.6 years. That is a very rapid growth rate. Now, here is a very interesting little something. Let me just go back to one. You can see in this that actually the curve does jump up and down quite a lot. It's not a nice smooth line. And on the little thing at the very top, I have given the average rates, that is the slopes of the line. They give the rates of increase. Normally it's about 7% per annum, and now it is about 20%, the very highest rate. And you can see that before World War I it went up, down during the war, up again between the wars, down again for World War II, up again with an over-recovery, and now steady. Now, that sort of thing of measuring the relative ups and downs over the long period, I've done here for the much longer period, from 1500 right through to the present day. Now, this is a graph of the following thing. We take any measure of science, we draw this exponentially increasing graph, do it on log paper so that it should be a straight line, and then we measure the little local alterations above and below the line, so that the straight line across the middle of this would mean a steady slope on the graph, continuous exponential increase. And if our curve is above the line, it is a growth rate. You can see it's got times 2 and times 1.5, divide by 1.5 and divide by 2. Those are growth rates twice and half the normal growth rate of science. So these are the periods when science is hot and when it is cool, as it were. But it is growing. The zero on that graph would be general exponential increase at the rate that it has been throughout history. Now, if you look at the recent period, let's look at the 19th and 20th century, from the time of Napoleon onwards. It's fairly steady round about the time of Napoleon, a little dip for that. And it goes up for the Industrial Revolution to about 1.5 times normal rate, slowly decreases, with little dips for each of the wars, including World War I and World War II, and recovery after World War II, and now dipping again to about the long-term historic trend.
Mm-hmm. What do you use as a measure of science?
This measure of science is taken from about 20 huge handbooks and histories of scientific events that are worth mentioning, like so-and-so's discovery of something, or so-and-so's famous paper. And all of these were counted up by slave-laboring graduate students, and the whole thing plotted there using a computer, taking the logarithm of the number, doing fairly sophisticated smoothing on it, because it jumps up and down with random noise quite badly. So this is a measure, I call it, of the pulse of science, the rate at which the heartbeat of science is going, faster or less fast than normal. Now, up on the left, you get a peak of activity at the time of Copernicus, another distinct peak at the time of Galileo, and another peak for our mid-17th century scientific revolution. followed by a huge trough, and then a slow building up again. Now, the peaks are Copernicus's time and Galileo's time, scientific revolution, a very broad peak for industrial revolution. The other things you can see are mostly troughs. Every time there is a war or major revolution, the pulse of science dips by something like a factor of two for the duration. It comes back again to normal afterwards. So that we do get little spurts of activity. I think the spurts on the left, the Copernicus and Galileo, are simply because when science is this small, as it is in the 1500s and 1600s, a considerable activity really shows up very, very clearly. So that if we could go back even further, there would be isolated peaks for these isolated events in history of science. It is only in the 1750s to 1800s that events in science really get thick and fast enough that there are so many each year that it smooths out. Before then, there may be only one or two per generation. Now, so much for the general things. The particular thing that I find terribly important and had not expected until I saw this was that after these great days of Newton and Boyle and Hooke and the early Royal Society and the Académie des Sciences, there is a period from the 1670s or 80s right the way through up to about the time of the French and American revolutions when science is really remarkably dull. Yeah?
Well, my question would be, would that necessarily be in science, or could that be something with a specific method? In other words, this right.
Good question. I had, but I didn't bring along, a comparable graph for the pulse of history. If one takes history books and does this, you do not find this effect. It is little different from random noise. It is a very steady thing, with pulses, however, for the main wars and revolutions.
What I meant was you're studying things as reported in books or something. Could it possibly just be that at that time it wasn't being reported?
No, it, one can show it isn't that, and I think I have this graph here. That it is, what you are seeing is not the pulse in the eyes of the historian, but the pulse of science itself. That's what you meant? Yeah, I think I can show you that in a minute. But let me just make this point while it's on the screen. This big trough, the depression after the scientific revolution, you could interpret, as I just said, you could say that, you know, Newton's a hard act to follow. They've made this big push, got out everything that could be gotten out using elementary mathematics. I mean, Newton did everything in sight that could be done by calculus, and the early Royal Society and Académie des Sciences did everything in sight that could be done with simple apparatus. And there wasn't anything much more to do. You could put it that way. I'd rather put it another way round and say that the real growth of science to its modern proportions is something that really begins in about the 1760s or 70s and leads up gradually. You see, I take that sweep of the curve and say it begins there, comes up gradually to the Industrial Revolution, and has remained pretty steady ever since. I mean, maybe that decrease from the peak of the Industrial Revolution downwards is an artifact, I don't know. It's not terribly big. It's a very steady sort of general decrease from the 1850s downwards, and now coming up in the post-World War II phase with what is called the new scientific technical revolution. And maybe it's the same sort of thing, just a new industrial revolution, a sort of sawtooth affair. Now, if you take that line, then you could say that the so-called scientific revolution of the mid-17th century was not really the beginning of our modern period, but was a preceding pulse, a precursor. That had to happen, maybe, but it happens one gets over it, and then 50 years later, or 60 or 70 years later, the true movement begins. Now, you remember when we saw the graph of the scientific journals, that you had your pulse of journals, and then they begin as if they were starting from 1700. And I think I myself would be in favour of that second of the two possible interpretations, not saying that the scientific revolution is a true beginning, but counting it as a sort of precursor, that the true coming of science into its modern maturation begins more or less with the rise of chemistry, electricity, and the coming industrial revolution. Yeah.
Why do you have the projection into the future about it? And why, I mean, what is the reason
for going down? This is not a projection into the future. The dotting ends at the present. The dotted part is something that I take from the modern data for the deployment of the world in science, taken from a quite different source. You see, the dotted part is not yet in history books and is not yet available in counts of papers. I took that dotted part from the actual count of papers that I showed you last. It is that thing on the top there that I've dotted on. The full curve is the computer average from the chronologies and the histories. And then I can go on, and this is what I just promised. This is not the eyes of the historian. This is a count of the number of scientific papers per year in a particular field, comparative anatomy. Now, it's a good field to take because obviously this has nothing to do with Newton. If there's one thing that Newton didn't do and know, it's comparative anatomy. Okay, these are publications in comparative anatomy, and there is your little pulse for the scientific revolution. You can see it between 1650 and 1700, and it's real enough for that, with a decline and then the exponential growth up right through to the Industrial Revolution. The decline afterwards is only because the bibliography isn't complete for those years. They were too recent, and the bibliographer hadn't collected them all. Okay? Yeah? Oh, no. That peak is only about 180 publications a year, and there must now be, I would say, 4,000 or 5,000 publications a year in comparative anatomy, and we haven't done yet.
I'm sort of saying some of the information, you may have to take into account various saturation points. For instance, that's something you can do without too much modern equipment. Now we're going to electron microscopy, and that becomes saturated.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm suggesting is that some of the data with the previous graph could be influenced by various regions.
Various saturations?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it could be. Let's go back to it. It could be, but I don't quite see how. It seems to me that other interpretations are much easier. You see, this is not the total amount that is saturating. This is, after all, the rate of growth. It is the second differential coefficient, effectively. And all of the troughs are things for well-known wars and events when people's minds were on very different things. And the only peaks that we have are the Copernicus-Galileo scientific revolution and then industrial revolution. All the other peaks are just created by troughs.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, perhaps for the pointer, if you don't have a slide of it, if you could show your projection for what would happen if this followed
What will happen, I guess, is that we're back on steady exponential growth. This is, after all, this is a picture of the world scientific information system, and I would expect at least another century of hovering around zero. If a war happens, we'll get a dip. If something exciting happens, we'll get some peak. but I shouldn't think it'll be much. I would expect there to be steady exponential growth of the doubling every 10 years, sort of a rate that is the world average. What I would expect, though, within that, is that the highly developed countries of the world will have virtually zero growth rate. Let me show you that a little later on, though, what I expect will happen in those areas, because this was a serious question last time, and I want to reduce the evidence for it this time. Let's go on. That one we talked about. Now, this is a quite different kettle of fish. Could you focus it again a little, please? I'm afraid it's rather difficult to see, but that's good. This is the only form I've got it in. Now, this is one of the very few things we have that measures the ups and downs, not of science, but of modern high scientific technology. This is a graph from 1960. An advertising firm in New York called Deutsche and Evans started counting these for their own benefit in 1960 and put them out to the advertising trade, mainly so that the advertising firms could see whether a good week or a bad week was them or the market. Okay? And now it is being published as a very widely observed indicator. It's a very good one because it's extremely sensitive and regular. It's much more regular than the stock market, and it runs ahead of the unemployment rate by a few months because the job advert situation develops a few months before people have actually taken the jobs. It takes some time to go round. This is the first sign one has of a boom or bust. And it is probably the best and the most efficient predictor for the state of the higher science and technology and for all the economics that goes with it. This also predicts the rise and fall of the GNP and exchange rates simply because they're based on the high technology industry. I mean, of course, if something happens quite outside the real economics and artificial manipulation, it's not going to show up. But this is a very good measure of what one might call the true economy and productivity of the nation.
Vertical axis, what are the delineations on the vertical axis?
This is normed to 100, and 100 is the one that the lines go to on the left, and then each of the major divisions is 10 points above and below the norm of 100, so that the graph is going to about 150, 160, and down to about 60. Okay? Now, things that you need to know. First of all the things at the top of the curve are very sharp. It is very easy and very quick to turn off science and technology. Turn off the high technology. A change in signals from the White House or the Senate, defusing of Vietnam War, things like that, cutting off of contracts, immediately takes you from an upward swing to a downwards one within 1 month. If, however, you want to turn on the economy again, to turn on the heat with new contracts in aerospace or something like that, then you get a very rounded curve that takes, nearly every time it is done, something like 1 year to turn around. High technology industry can be turned off within the month, probably within the week. It takes a year to turn on again. This business on the right, this waffling up and down, is the uncertainty at Watergate. What happened now was this curve came down and has been turning around for about the past year, and as of about 2 months ago, began very uncertainly going up. I imagine it will now hover until in comes Carter, and then one will see what it does. Because you'll note that on each change of president, there is a change of signals. If we take Kennedy, he changes round the downslope on the left to an up. There is the coming of Kennedy, creating an up. After about a year in office, changes signals. In comes Johnson with an up. After about, what is it, a year and a half, 2 years in office, changes signals, comes down again. In comes Nixon, goes down, changes signals, goes up again. In comes Ford, comes down, changes signals, goes up again. It is as if the norm is for a president to play the first part of the term by different rules than you play the second part of the term. There would seem decent political sense in this, yeah?
Can you explain the various dips and falls in relation to Vietnam or the space program?
It's very interesting. As a matter of fact, I cannot. I can follow them in the periods that where there were increasing military and other engineering and civilian projects, and then they are followed by turnarounds to decreasing ones. But they're very consistent policies that run for habitually at least a year, maybe a couple of years, and then there's a change round. But one can see these changes, the oscillations around the Eden progress are probably no greater than the error of measurement. I mean, after all, it's only a few hired people counting ads in papers, and you wouldn't expect this to have the accuracy that the stock market does, for example, where you can record numbers of shares. But really, it is rather more regular. The random noise on the stock market's much greater. And for that, the operators of the stock market are duly grateful. On this, the random noise is small, and you get consistent policies that you can see, and they correspond to the sort of grand periods in the politics of the country, and such a thing is an indicator worth noticing. Now, so much for the particular interest of it. Step aside and look at the general point. What we have here is typical, I think, of what you would get if you measured anything in technology and industry, that it depends on the political, economic, social climate. You can see decision-making in practice. You might find it difficult to say what those decisions were and interpret them, but someone, somewhere, made a decision and altered the course of policy, and policy goes for a year or two like that, and then gets turned around. Now, this is in total contrast to science, where we've seen there is a uniform trend, and only on the grand historical scale do we perceive rather small increases in rate and decreases in rate when there are major events like war. Technology is in the pocket of all of the political, social, economic forces. You can change it and do what you like with it. The science is very deterministic in its general growth pattern, and it is fine-tuned only very little by the forces of history. Let me go on, sir. Now, here's the evidence for the 1967 business. There are three graphs here for the US. The top one is let's start at the bottom. The bottom one is the growth in the GNP. Fairly steady, regular growth in the productivity of the United States. The next one up is R&D expenditures that, as you can see, begin to slope off. And on the top is the R&D as a percentage of the GNP of the country, and it goes up and up and up, with a doubling about every 6.5 years, until one gets to the 1960s, when it begins to slacken, and in 1965-67, there you can see it has hit ceiling at order of magnitude 3 and a bit %, and it has been there ever since.
Do you have the recent figures for the past 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, they're about 3-3.5%. it's dead flat to the right. Now, here's something different again. It's a little set of six graphs, all related and all doing the same thing. Now, these are taken from the big computer printout that handles all the world's scientific literature, and what I've done is not to count papers, which are a little bit meaningless, but to count the number of people in the world, or in the world, in the country, or in the state of the US, that are authors of scientific papers. Now, here we have one where I have, for the states of the United States, the count of number of authors vertically. It's on a logarithmic scale, so that 2 means 100, 3 means 1,000, 4 means 10,000. And this is a count of the number of authors in each state measured against the census figure for the number of scientists in that state. Now, first of all, it reads from the top downwards. You can see it gives the pecking order in the scientific size of the states. New York and California are way out ahead as the big two in both authors and in numbers of scientists. And at the bottom, you've got places like Nevada, South Dakota, Alaska, Wyoming, Vermont, Maine, and so on. Connecticut is... We're in that square where there are 10 of them all at the same point. They're only arranged in a square because we couldn't put the 10 names on one point. Now, that is just to show that the number of authors does match census figures where pretty well where you happen to have both. You see, we don't have census figures on the same basis for numbers of scientists in the countries of the world, so I had to check it by taking the case in which we do have them. And then again, you can see that sometimes there's a slight discrepancy to the left above, and sometimes a slight discrepancy to the right below. Now you see, if you get a state where the number of authors is rather high relative to the trend of the number of scientists, then you have a state that is mainly academic and research scientists. If you have a state that is down at the bottom, then you have a state that is higher in scientists than it is in people who are publishing research, and therefore it is probably using them in industry more than any other. So it gives you, reading this way, the complexion between very academic states and very scientific engineering sort of states. Now, at the top, you have Massachusetts and D.C., Rhode Island, Hawaii and Vermont, which are academic mill sort of states with little industry. At the bottom, you have Delaware, for example, Louisiana and Oklahoma with their oil, Delaware with the chemical industry and so on. So that this agrees pretty well and gives an indication that one is doing something right. Now, however, we're not terribly interested in the absolute size of the state because states differ in size quite a lot. So one wants to be much more interested in the density of science. That is, how many scientists per capita are there? And what I've spread it out against is simply the wealth of the state in income per capita. You expect the very wealthy states to be fairly highly developed educationally and industrially, and the poor states vice versa, and therefore there should be agreement. Well, lo and behold, there's reasonable agreement. Now, the states that are very high in per capita science, Massachusetts, Maryland, National Institute of Health, you see, are way up the top there. Now, what are the curiosities? Well, you have Nevada, which has a very high income per capita, but not the science to match it. Well, if Nevada didn't have its gambling dens, it would be West Virginia or Kentucky, you see. Similarly, you have way up there New Mexico. And if New Mexico did not have Los Alamos, it would be Maine. You get the... So again, we have a reasonable interpretation there, showing that indeed the amount of scientific development of a state, of which you can read there, there's Connecticut up with about the same amount of development per capita as New York or California, and also amongst the wealthiest of the states. The ones that are way out in left field are curiosities where there are big scientific stations of one sort or another, and the ones that are down in this field are ones that are artificially rich, Nevada and Alaska. Apart from that, you can get the range from the highly developed states to the least highly developed, and in fact one can see up there that Connecticut really doesn't come out of that too well, in spite of the fact that we're all there helping them. Now, here's another thing. We've got about 10 years of data and can measure the growth rate of each state. And if one plots that, you see that in general, the largest states, California and New York, have the least growth rate. Now, that line through the middle is the average growth rate of the country. These are so much below it that it is about the least possible growth rate, and I suggest that, in fact, this minus 5 is about zero growth. That is about the 2 or 3% per annum of average growth rate of the U.S., and the top is about 6 or 7% per annum, which is maximum growth rate. You can see that, in general, the bigger and more developed the state is, the smaller is its relative growth rate. Now, of course, you'd expect the absolute one to be smaller, but the relative one is much smaller. You can see there the... You can see there the states that are doing rather well in having a high growth rate relative to the amount that they developed already are District of Columbia, Texas, Georgia, Florida, Virginia, California and New York aren't doing too badly either. But way down the bottom, you have the underprivileged states that are really growing at what ought to be for them an alarmingly small growth rate. Puerto Rico, Delaware. I mean, the industry in Delaware has a bad growth rate. Okay? Now, here then are the brownie points of the countries of the world in their absolute size, and they're just spread out against something much better than income per capita. That's difficult to do with nations because you can't translate rubles into pesetas so very easily. So what I took is something that the nations haven't found out how to cook yet, and that is kilowatt hours of energy. And this is then the energy size of the nation and the scientific size of the nation. You can see United States way out ahead with the other big countries, USSR, UK, Germany, France, Canada, and Japan. Then a gap, and then all the other major nations of the world, and then at the bottom, the basket cases of the countries that scarcely have anything of energy or scientific authors. And again, you can see this, on this immediately, you can see left field and right field. A right field, there's not very much. Well, let's take left field. The biggest anomaly is Israel, which has about six times as many scientists as you would expect for a country of that energy size. The other countries that are very basic science-oriented are Switzerland, Hungary, Denmark, Ireland, Lebanon, before the last war there, Ceylon or Sri Lanka, Ethiopia,
I mean, a typical basket case country, it hasn't got anything except a high-grade university for diplomatic staff and a good hospital for the embassy people, so they produce papers.
At the bottom end of countries that have the least possible amount of science for their development, very interestingly, are virtually all of the Spanish-speaking countries. Cuba, Philippines, Colombia, Mexico, Brazil, Spain.
Now, what is going on there is the difficulty of scientific literature. Spanish is the only major literary language of the world of considerable punch and cultural history and influence. I mean, when you have Spanish as your language, you don't go away from it readily. It's not as if you spoke Hungarian. When you have Spanish, it is a major literary resource, but the scientific resources in Spanish are totally inadequate. I mean, it is impossible to get halfway through an undergraduate career reading books written in Spanish. It is impossible to get near the research front. Therefore, education has suffered. It's being changed rapidly and needs to be changed as rapidly as the science policy buffs of the Latin American countries and Spain can arrange. Now, let us move on to... Whoops, I've missed one. Yeah, okay. Here we have the intensity of development. Scientist per person and energy per person. So now this is a size-independent measure of the quality of the various countries of the world. From bottom to top, we have the scientific intensity of development, and from left to right, we have the economic or industrial intensity of development. Now, there's some anomalies. To the right, we have Norway, and that's completely artificial because it just happens that they have this huge water power industry. The water hydroelectric generation of electricity, and it shouldn't be there at all. It should be moved over a whole block to the left and be almost the same as Denmark. That's just what you get for taking kilowatt hours of energy. They export it, they don't use it. Then again, on left field, we have Israel with, again, far more science per capita than the big science countries like UK, Sweden, United States, Canada, and Switzerland, which are all much of a muchness. Then again, you have the countries that are making a mistake in having purely academic science with nothing milked out of it. Egypt, India, Sri Lanka, Ethiopia, Pakistan, Thailand, Iraq, and so on. These have a university but haven't used it yet. And now within that, one can see that, again, you have reasonable agreement. As a country develops industrially, it increases the amount of its science, or vice versa. You can't tell which is the cause and which effect. They go together. And again, down on the right, you tend to get those Spanish-speaking countries. And now we have the clincher, the growth rate of the countries of the world against their size and therefore their development. On the left you have the most undeveloped countries in the world, Zambia, New Guinea, Ceylon, Costa Rica, Madagascar, Vietnam, Ethiopia, Korea, and so on. On the right you have the US way out there. Well, again, that's the world's average at about 7% per annum. Zero is 7% per annum. Down here somewhere, as low as you can go, which is about this level. Now, this one is way below it. It's Uruguay, and I think there was war, revolution, or something horrendous happening, and it went down. So forget that one. Romania, Czechoslovakia,
It's probably round about zero growth rate. And at the 2% level or so, you have United States, UK, USSR, Germany, France, Japan, Israel, Austria, Sweden, Switzerland, Italy. You see, all those major countries. But now you look at the countries that still have very high growth rates of about 15%, and amongst them are cases like Brazil and Spain and Nigeria and Chile and Iran. You've got a whole lot of countries with large populations and large growth rates. I mean, it may all go kaput, but there is a large reservoir of rapidly growing population. Yeah?
Is that right over the top of Japan, France, and India there?
Right over where?
Right over the top of Japan, France, and Germany is India. Just a little way to the left. Is that India? Above
there. Here's India.
And didn't they used to have a real rapid growth rate or something?
Well, they sure don't anymore.
Was mandatory?
In India, you see, is one of those countries that is on the left on the previous graph. It has the legacy of British imperialism with built-up British-style universities that are totally unrelated to the social or political or economic needs of the country. In fact, they're destructive in providing enormous numbers of people who are fit only for civil service functionaries in a country that needs anything more than bureaucracy. And that's what's gone wrong with the Indian universities and their growth rate. They cannot be further supported. Same for Pakistan. Right, now we get on to something different. Can we get a little focus on that? Next thing I want to show is what happens when you take a field and you link papers together using a recent technique called citation analysis, where you take the references in the papers and you see how similar they are to references in other papers. It's called co-citation, and it's a very strong indication that the papers are dealing with the same thing. You're matching not just single ones, but many references against references. Now, this happens to be fairly recent papers in nuclear physics, the highly cited ones, and the lines between show links much more than you expect in the amount that those papers occur together. What you can do is to let them fall into place as a sort of map of papers linked tightly together. Now, it doesn't matter whether you take the papers or, on the next slide, we take the words that occur in the abstracts of the papers that give you an indication of what this link or group really is. And you can follow this map of the subject matter from one end of nuclear physics to another. Now, if you now take, this is a different subject, this is reverse transcriptase in cancer research and DNA work. What you can do is to do it very quantitatively, taking not just a scheme with bands between, but put the papers and the fields at exact distances, so that the distance between points corresponds to the link between the subjects. And it turns out when you do this that you can create an entire map of science. Now, it's weird, because you would expect the structure of science to be so complicated that it would take many dimensions to describe. As it happens, the picturesque language that we use of fields and breakthroughs and borderlines and things like that is accurate. It's really like exploring a territory and making a map. And it turns out that one can indeed map locally and at large all of the body of science, and we'll probably be having this on a computer graphic printout within a couple of years. This was just the pioneer paper in it by Griffiths and Small just 2 years ago that started this big chase off. Now, when you do that, suddenly you get a much more precise and empirical idea of what the structure of science really looks like than any historian could ever see before.
Now, we haven't been able to go through watching the map change through history, but fairly soon we'll be able to get it on a month-to-month basis and almost watch it behaving like a cartoon. And we've already seen some preliminary accounts of this and know what to look for. And what the way it works turns out to be very much like what you would imagine if there were a great jigsaw puzzle of all the world's papers that had been begun in 1670 with some cluster that had grown to this size now, and there are pieces strewn out all on the floor, and the million scientists of the world are standing around picking up pieces and trying to fit them into the puzzle. How does such a puzzle grow out? Now, based on this idea, we can see the mode of growing of a puzzle. Now, let's start on the left with number one on the left top corner. The rule of the game is that science is so difficult that you can't put down a piece just by wanting to. You can't just fish around and come out with something, because if a piece is easy to fit in, it's already been done. Somewhere, somebody is very clever. So we get to stage two, where two people have been clever, and a bit has been put in on the right on top, and another bit has been put in on the right at the bottom. Two people have been very clever. Now, immediately they have done their clever thing, it is no longer true that anything that can be done has been done. Because in those two places where you have new action, there are new conditions. And all you have to do is to know that area and that sort of piece, and you will see new pieces that go where the old ones were just joined on, creating the new circumstances. So we get to frame three, where the top one has now sparked two more, and the bottom one has now sparked two more in the immediate vicinity. So we go on to four, where two bud-like clusters are growing, and in five, they have grown out in sort of pseudopods. If you've ever watched an amoeba move under a microscope by putting out pseudopods, or you can imagine this thing like some climbing plant is putting out tendrils. Well, there are two research tendrils growing out, and there's a little space between them. And in number six, you see that the space between has been plugged, and leaving a couple of holes in the middle, which are immediately filled in. Now, that's the general sort of case of what Tom Kuhn calls the growth of normal science. It will work for normal technology, too. Each little addition represents a logical consequence on something that existed before. A paper is put down on the basis of a few previous papers to which it most often refers, and upon which it is built. Now, maybe there intervene new experimental results and things, but something is growing out of the living research front of science. And exponential growth implies that each paper is giving birth at a constant birth rate to new papers, that is, this tacking on process, that addition to the map of knowledge creates further additions. Each solution of a question creates further questions at constant birth rate. Now, that is not all that can happen. You see in number six that we have this big growth area and then a little peninsula at the top. And in frame number seven, what has happened is that there is some area that has grown up. The map needn't be continuous. There may be other areas. I mean, remember, at the time of Newton, we have the astronomy area and the mechanics areas that get stuck together. Well, here's a little area that has grown up without it being tied to anything. You know, just somebody found pieces that fitted together in a puzzle, and now they start looking and hunting. What happens is that this big growth area that's been achieved shakes down, distorts. Each thing that you do distorts the map of science behind it. As you go on doing more and more, you realize that you don't need
to come up this roundabout way, but you can cut out wrong steps and do things in new ways, and this area shrinks away, gradually making a place that it is now perceived that one fits in. And when that changes, that big distortion and push that is needed with a sort of rubber sheet geometry to fit things in this forcible way, that is what is called a paradigm change. You change the ground rules and change the whole shape of science of the time and the way you think about it and the way it gives rise to further questions. And from time to time, as the puzzle grows normally, this sort of distortion process will happen, this sort of fitting in process will happen, and sometimes, indeed, it might happen that one finds that, like peanuts, jigsaw puzzle has been put together wrong. It's been forced into position, and it doesn't belong there. And you have to take out a whole area and put it in some other way. And then, there too, you find a major change taking place in science. Now, one of the ways in which this distortion happens very frequently is in the way that science grows not by jigsaw puzzling, but by the intrusion of technology. Remember the story of Galileo's telescope, that way. When that happens, then when technology comes in, suddenly you find out how to fit more pieces. It is as if technology is a sort of pattern printed on the jigsaw puzzle map of science, and science is a pattern printed on the jigsaw puzzle map of technology, that every time science comes in, rather unexpectedly, it makes technology do something different that you didn't expect. And every time technology comes in with a new machine or new phenomenon that you didn't expect, it gives you a new turn to science. So just as in the way in which we sometimes go by the picture rather than the shape of the puzzle, so we can get a lead from this interaction of the science and the technology.